This week, what I want to do is to look at using some of the inventions that have occurred in the context of rituals. In the context of mainly, I'm using mainly the British context and the South African context as examples, because that probably, for the simple reason that most of you know the British context better than I do, and then I happen to know the South African context better than the British context. So we'll kind of compare these examples and see how it pans out. Couple of theoretical questions that I want to kind of keep at the back of my head as I kind of browse through these materials is, for example, is there a continuity of some original substratum in the new inventions of rituals in the diaspora context? And secondly, well, this has to do with my sort of concern for the essentialist approach to how Hinduism gets defined, as opposed to a non-essentialist approach, kind of social, empirical, historical kind of approach to defining Hinduism. Of course, it would eventually border on how we talk about religion, defining religion at a broader kind of thing, but I would limit myself to, you know, Hinduism in particular. So can an essentialist construction of Hinduism help us understand global Hindu developments? So that's kind of reversing, you know, the question really. In other words, if Hinduism is defined in a kind of constant invocation of the ancient, archaic, some substratum that somehow survives into the present, and then how that actually is rehearsed and somehow seen as the somehow enduring thing that we base our definitions on, and somehow, you know, kind of understand this unchanging, you know, immutable kind of substance that we contend, you know, is it something that is this permanent substance that is somehow rehearsed from time to time, like Eliade's kind of thing, myth of the eternal return? Or are we seeing in the diaspora context and all of these modern globalized kind of context new things? Perhaps not connected to the old, but new things happening. If so, how do we account for those things? So let's see how this pans out. I begin with this rather outlandish kind of experiment, that Tirupati temple in Andhra Pradesh in India, South India, a little north of Madras actually, began to sort of experiment with. I don't know whether they're still doing it. I think they are somehow, I think, doing it, but I don't know how big it is now. But one thing that they started to do was to attract the NRIs, mainly, I think, in the U.S., really, to have them perform their rituals in absentia, which is kind of unthinkable in the olden days. In other words, you can actually book your sort of date and time and the kind of ritual that you want to perform with this temple, and the priest would perform those rituals for you and your family and what have you, and then mail you the prasadam, the, you know, this sacred sort of material that you could, you know, share with your family by Federal Express, U.S. Federal Express. or in what is it? What do you call here? The
DHL,
yeah, DHL, or TNT, one of these things. So what does that actually mean? And that's the kind of thing that I'm thinking about.
Was it ever inaugurated in India itself? Like people who lived, say, in northern India could... what I mean is this an extension from something which was already started in India through popular demand?
No, I think...
Or was it inaugurated from...
I think it's a peculiar US initiative, really. You see, one of the things that happens is U.S. has this large concentration of not only Hindus from other sort of lower sort of sections of the society. I mean, it's kind of politically incorrect to use those terms now. But let's say the non-Brahmanical caste groups. And then you have also very orthodox caste, I mean, Brahmanical groups. And for them... some of the domestic rituals, say, for instance, when somebody passed on, now you have to technically really perform those rituals in your hometown or village with relevant sort of, priests, specialist priests performing those rituals. For instance, the Sri Vaishnavas in South India, or the Orthodox the Smartha Brahmins. So they have specific rituals that they perform, and they have to do it in those locations and so on. Now, that was probably the context in which these initiatives originated, actually. So they would have to have these done there. Now, the question is whether they could do it in absentia, or whether they have to fly in there and do it there. I think some compromise was made here that one of their relatives could represent, and then they could perform those and then have the prasadam and the relevant stuff mailed to them so that they could do their ritual, follow-up rituals in, say, Michigan or Florida or wherever. It didn't seem to affect the British and the South African context, this kind of thing. This is probably, because of the less orthodox Hindus that have immigrated to this country and South Africa, largely non-Brahmanical groups. It's only in the last couple of decades, or maybe a decade really, that the more sort of professional, sort of qualified professional groups are coming to UK, some of whom could be Brahmanical sort of groups. But prior to that, it's mainly immigrants from all kinds of backgrounds, mainly working class, lower strata communities and so on that have come here, the Punjabis and the Gujarati business groups and the refugees from Sri Lanka and so on. So for them, this wasn't an issue. But I think subsequently, it could become an issue. Just to kind of to look at the issue that I raised, I have a quotation that I took from Huikas. He says the following: moreover, a rapidly growing population confined to the same geographical boundaries and for lack of industry restricted to the same occupations, creative and artistic, seems to have found an outlet in the manufacturing, in parentheses he's got in the forgotten literal sense of the word. I'm not sure what the literal sense was, but...
Made by hand.
Oh, I see. Okay. Of gradually more and more complicated offerings, so that at the outset one is far from sure whether it will be possible to find, let alone easy to find, the original religious substratum, which has become inextricably mixed with a lush development of aesthetics, even at times light-hearted elements. So in other words, in this massive kind of new inventions that have been taking place in the diaspora, in the community, whether we could actually detect that original kind of essence that has continued, and what exactly it is of course a perennial problem. Now, the inventions, of course, is nothing new to the diaspora context. Even in the Indian context, such inventions were common during the Mughal period. For instance, Sumit Guha points out that in the Mughal time, the classical notion of dharma was what was known as Maharashtra dharma. In other words, in the usage of, say for instance, criminal justice system, in the development of criminal justice system by the British Empire in India, whether British colonial administrators, the magistrates and so on, made use of the ancient laws of Manu or Hindu dharma, we were talking about this in the morning, or whether they in fact based on the local variations, the customary laws that existed among local groups. Sumit Guha seems to think that even prior to the British, already by the Mughal period, they were using not necessarily the ancient laws of Manu, but actually what was known as, for instance, in the context of Maharashtra, the Maharashtra dharma. Dharma, the key word dharma, is simply used in a kind of a generic sense. No particular sort of textual reference was made to any ancient text. Just to kind of, you know, for instance, like most of the modern neo-Hindus make reference to Vedas. You know, oh, it's in the Vedas. You know, you don't know what they are referring to. And no particular Veda is actually, you know, if you then ask which particular Veda are you talking about, you know, he wouldn't know. So it's that kind of generic kind of reference. So he further notes that Peshwas and though Brahmins, for instance, were less influenced by Sanskrit scriptures on matters of criminal jurisprudence. Now, these inventions are in consonant with changes in priesthood. Shirley Firth, for instance, points out in the context of the British Hindus that the distinction between pure Brahmins and the Brahmins who perform funerary rituals has disappeared. I think this happens also to a certain extent in the urban space in India. For instance, in Delhi and bigger cities, where it's simply not possible to have the same technical priest to perform those particular rituals. But at least in India, you would not have a Brahmin priest who performs marriages, for instance, performing funeral ceremonies. They wouldn't do that. It's distinctly separate, not only because it is a separate type of activity, but there are ritual implications for those Brahmins who perform these sets of rituals. Some are considered impure, and so no pure Brahmin would perform these. In other words, coming in contact with impure substance, that's basically the point, really. In other words, that's the basis of caste in the Indian social system, in the system. In other words, what distinguishes different levels of society is the substance code. What can you exchange with another group of individuals? So, and there are exceptions, you know, what you can exchange and to what extent you can come in proximity with that substance or people who come in contact with that substance. So therefore, you know, interdining, marriage, etc., have to do with the exchange of substance. So that substance code actually is the basis of the caste system. It's and that's why the four class grouping of Varna system doesn't really make much sense in the broader Indian context, because you get into highly differentiated kind of things when you begin to see how these things pan out. Say, for instance, a Brahmin would have less difficulty coming in contact with a washerman who washes his clothes than to come in contact with even a Banya, for instance, or another Shudra, upper caste Shudra community. So it's just, you know, what is it that he can exchange, come in contact with? So that it gets very complicated when you examine those variables.
Would there be any limits, for instance, to a Kashmiri Brahmin performing rituals or a Punjabi Brahmin?
Yeah.
Ah, well, that's interesting, because at Eleanor's stepdaughter's wedding, a Kashmiri Brahmin performed the ceremony, and Ram is a Punjabi Brahmin. But the particular person who did it is one of the few people who can.
Yeah. Yeah.
Both people being married who won't know the Sanskrit, but also people pretending to be a mixture.
In Indian context, it wouldn't happen, but here, I'm sure it can happen because of a number of reasons.
That's a video of that.
I think it would be nice to see some of these things and have a discussion, actually. So she says, actually, while in theory the pandit who has to take funerals and thus acts as the ritual scapegoat for the sins of the deceased person has diminished status in comparison with pure Brahmins, in Britain such distinctions may become less clear, since the same pandit normally also has to conduct auspicious ceremonies such as marriages. So that kind of distinction in Britain and in South Africa, for instance, it doesn't even exist. I mean, it doesn't make any difference, really, because in the first place, the so-called Brahmin is not even Brahmin by birth. It's something kind of an acquired status. That is, you sort of, you know, start doing these rituals because you are able to perform these rituals because you know some of those things. Or you taught yourself some of these things, and that's how you get to become, you get to be known as Brahmin, not because you are born into that caste. So the idea of priest, Brahmin, without caste affiliations becomes an important development. Referring to the work of Mensky, Firth argues that despite the claims of some pundits that there is only one way to perform a particular ritual, the content of ritual is constantly being renegotiated and developed according to need. Mensky shows that classical Hindu law favored continuous ritual innovation and flexibility, in which there is a complex conglomerate of Sanskrit and local caste customary practices that show quite considerable flexibility. In other words, she's trying to justify these innovations on the basis that there is already that kind of precedence in the ancient practice. This invention of ritual procedures has also implications for how one understands auspicious and inauspicious times, spaces, and so on. The new inventions and adjustments are often and invariably followed by the attempts on the part of the priest to explain the procedures and meanings and so on. Now, this is very interesting. It doesn't happen in India, even in the urban space. One simply assumes that it's either unnecessary to explain or that people kind of are used to these things, and so no need for any explanation. Although in the urban cities and, you know, cosmopolitan cities, hardly anyone really knows, really. And so there is always this joke, you know, when the Brahmin priest is reciting these Sanskrit mantras and so on, these youngsters are, you know, at the back, you know, making jokes, really. You know, what's he talking about? You know, what? So is he actually making up things, or, you know, whether there is really any mantra that he's reciting, you know.
Don't they use a manual, though?
Yeah.
You can see them referring.
I mean, there is this famous little anecdote, anecdote about this pundit, at this wedding, reciting these mantras, and then takes this couple in the middle of day, really, to show this particular star in the sky. And the star that he is referring to is the star of Arundhati, which is part of this, many of you know this, the Big Dipper, the seven, what do you call it? So there is at the bottom of the seventh star, there is another minor star known as Arundhati in the Indian cosmography. These seven stars are representing seven rishis, sages, and Arundhati is the wife of this seventh rishi. And there is always this link between Arundhati and this sage, Agastya, that they are the ideal couple. So in weddings, the priest actually invokes upon these ideal couple to kind of, you know, sort of emphasize to them the need for that kind of harmonious living and so on. And apparently this guy, you know, looking up this star, he says, I can't find anything. The only thing that I can find is this massive debt that I have in front of me. So, because that kind of tells you the extent to which people take loans and, you know, the Indian marriages that are so massive, expensive. So the only thing that he could think of is this, you know, debt, you know, that he has to somehow, you know, pay off eventually. So he's not actually thinking of this Arundhati star and all that. So it's kind of tells you how sometimes these rituals become meaningless to people. Hmm. The inventions would also take into account different client needs, caste status, and area of origin. In Britain, such details are still important, whereas in South Africa, such details are becoming less important, even non-existent, really. They may have taken some kind of long process of evolution in the context of South Africa, where, for instance, Tamils would do in a certain way because of the place of origin and the general caste background from where they came and so on. But over time in South Africa, they have taken specific South African sort of character, so that to this day, some of these rituals they perform as if they are, these are the orthodox things. So they become the orthodox practices for them, not the ones that Sri Lankan priests perform and follow and so on. For instance, again, Kimnot, talking about the Leeds Hindu community, she says, in the Leeds at the present time, where the mandir is situated in an old stable building where the practitioner has only assumed a priestly role in recent years, and where the Hindu calendar is removed from such well-known dangers as monsoon and uncontrollable disease, such an ideal is far from possible. In other words, we were talking about, at the beginning of the session, the planning issues, in the construction of the temples and so on. So the ideal construction of mandir and so on doesn't probably happen in the context of the British sort of construction of the mandirs and so on.
The issue of the calendar is interesting. In Leicester, for example, Diwali lights are put up. That's the marking of that festival. Then they're switched off at the end of Diwali, and then switched on again for Christmas, the same lights. There was a tremendous sense of
continuity. Yeah.
And I don't even know the Shat Working Party produces a calendar of religious festivals each year.
Yeah.
And when Clive Lawton was editing that, which is not at the moment, a small group of people was doing it, in finding the Hindu dates was, it's extremely difficult to do it accurate, but he consulted very widely and then had to make a decision and did. After a couple of years of this being part of the calendar, he was being rung up by leaders of the Hindu community to ask him what the date was.
Mm.
So the Shat group, as it were, became the authority of the community.
Yeah.
Of course, he pointed out, wait a minute, this is the wrong way around. That's not how we do it. We actually try and consult you and find out and make the best decision we can in the light of decisions.
Yeah.
But it just shows how things.
Yeah.
Interesting relationship to what you're saying before, right? They couldn't agree on the dates.
Yeah. So there is a certain homogenization that takes place, in spite of them coming from all kinds of different places, and you get this north-south Indian calendars, almanac. For instance, the New Year dates. You have Telugu New Year, the Tamil New Year, and then you have the I think the Telugu and the Hindi New Year's correspond closely. They more or less kind of with a day this way, that way, come close. But the Tamil New Year is different. And then the manner in which they calculate the lunar days, especially when they have, say, for instance, somebody passed away this month today, and then if they have to perform the 9-day ritual and then the 16-day ritual and then finally the annual ceremony, they calculate in such a way it doesn't happen exactly on the same day, same month, the following year. It's calculated in such a way that it actually has taken into account the lunar progression rather than the actual modern sort of calendar date. So, and then the Tamils would calculate differently, the Hindis will calculate differently, so, all kinds of things happen. But generally speaking, the public rituals, public festivals and so on, there is a certain understanding when, for instance, Diwali would take place, or when, for instance, the good times and bad times in a day are kind of indicated in the calendar. So the Rahu Kala, the bad time, and the Kuligan, that is the good time. All of these are indicated, and there is a general agreement among all of these communities as to which they are. And these are printed by temples and then circulated. And you can obtain a copy from a temple, the almanac, and then follow that. So, so it's interesting how the various local situations are taken into consideration in coming up with those things, and certainly in the context of South Africa, for instance, why they eventually ended up having Sunday at 4 o'clock, for instance, all their worship activities, is because the farm owners, in the sugarcane industry context, allowed them only on Sunday, that free time. So they could actually, regardless of where they came from, what their ritual procedures were, etc., that's the only time they had. So they had to somehow adjust to that circumstance and develop that same thing. And in the British context, you have a generally declared Sunday holiday, so they couldn't just go off to temples in the middle of the day working for another employer, and the employer may not give you the leave and so on. So these are some of the adjustments that the diaspora context brings about. One of the most interesting developments in the diaspora Hinduism is that, unlike patriarchal transmission method in the traditional Brahmanical order of Hinduism, in the diaspora, mothers and daughters are the key transmitters of tradition. I think this is an interesting development that has ritual implications. In fact, this actually underlines the general Hindu ethos of what being religious means, really. In other words, for instance, generally you could be Hindu and you don't really need to go to a temple or appear to be religious. 95% of Hindus, really, you can, at the same time, you can't describe them as secular either. That's the way it is. You are Hindu, and what it is actually doesn't appear as these various religious activities that one does, but rather it's just that awareness, I don't know what it is, but you could be a Hindu without being religious. Like Deepankar Gupta, a political scientist from JNU, Jawaharlal Nehru University, the other day giving a keynote address at in Lund University, Sweden, he said Hinduism and caste, they don't exist in India. It was quite sort of provocative when he said that, but what he meant was, on a daily basis, people actually don't think about these things. They don't actually operate on those lines. And secondly, the caste-related ritual, procedures and all of those rules, etc., don't actually have any meaning, or they don't actually happen even in a smaller town, let alone in an urban space. In other words, if you really have to see these rules applied, you have to go to a very homogeneous, small little village where these rules actually have ritual implications. The caste, hierarchies and so on have ritual implications, which you don't see in the urban space, even in smaller towns and so on. So he therefore says that caste actually doesn't exist in India in the sense in which it is described in classical texts and so on, which is actually how social scientists have somehow used without unpacking its implications. So there is that kind of tendency to now in social scientific work to think about caste as a different phenomenon rather than as something that is as though cast in stone through classical texts and so on, mediated through these Brahmanical priests and so on. It's more a kind of, today, for instance, in the context of South Africa, a lot of caste names exist. Naidu, Reddy, all of these things. But what it means is simply a kind of an affiliation, a memory of what who you were and so on. And of course, you could also acquire those names, and you know, by the second generation, no one knows that you acquired it, because you move on to another location, or your children have gone off to other places and so on. So nobody knows where you came from. So they would have no difficulty in thinking that you are a Reddy. Because in the absence of ritual rules and ritual connections, you know, what does Reddy mean anyway? So, you know, but in the context of, say, if you went to Melkote, for instance, a typical Brahmanical village, even to this day, you would then very immediately, you know, be confronted with these things. Everyone knows where they belong. And, you know, the town itself is organized in a way that reflects that hierarchy, those ritual responsibilities. In other words, ritual responsibilities are given to different caste communities, and they perform those rules on a daily basis. There is, when I was there, I used to watch this guy who every day, without fail, come and play the drums. And he belongs to a particular caste. That was his caste duty, to perform that, playing the drum and playing the trumpet and so on. And there is a place at which he has to stand in relation to the temple when he comes in. That's where he stood. And I asked him how long he has been doing that. He said, not only me, my generations in the past have been doing this. You know, so I'm just following it. So now when he moves to California, for instance, you know, what happens? You know, he could, you know, that ritual falls away and that status falls away, because there is no way anybody could control his, you know, sort of caste status in the absence of that particular ritual that he performed.
Would he move to California? If somebody is so aware of, you know, the generational responsibilities in the caste, are
well,
they the person who's likely to sort of up sticks and...
Well,
it sounds by the way you describe them that they're mentally and physically fixed.
Well, ideally one would think that it
yeah.
would be impossible for him or her to move to a place like California, but lo and behold, Iyers left
yeah.
India.
Mm.
It was impure
yes.
even to consider traveling across the seas. You know, Gandhi, when he went back to India, let alone an Iyer Brahmin, Smartha Brahmin and so on, even Gandhi, who wasn't a Brahmin, from the Banya caste.
What would persuade an Iyer to leave then?
Money.
Yeah.
simple as that.
That was a very
simple as that.
Answer.
Simple as that. I mean, you know, when, for instance, the famous example, Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan, who chaired this Spalding chair. How did he end up coming here? If he were, I mean, he belongs to one of the most orthodox Brahmin communities, you know. Even his community would be even more orthodox than the Iyers and the Iyengars in Tamil Nadu. The Shastris, he belongs to the Shastri community. They are the Pandits. And they read only the Vedic texts. Now, how did he travel across the seas, and he knows that it was impure, and he broke those ritual rules, and he came here, and he studied and, you know, did all kinds of things. Of course, when these people went back, you know, his mothers and whoever ritually purified them. You know, they did those things. So it's kind of, it becomes like a joke, you know, you kind of publicly do other things to fit in, and then privately perform other things. So this public posturing and private sort of hidden rituals, if you, that's why in the Sri Vaishnava tradition, for instance, you have a whole genre of secret rituals, Rahasya Grandhas, they are called. No one from the outside can read them. You have to be ritually initiated to read those texts. So they are called secret texts. Daniel Smith, who pursued these rituals for over 25 years, trying to, you know, unlock the mysteries of these so-called secret texts, couldn't. Eventually he gave up, piling up this massive material at Syracuse. I don't know where they ended up in eventually. So you would have to be initiated. He was initiated, actually, you know, to be honest. And he would dress up like a Brahmin. But he, you know, and still these Pancharatra priests would never actually demonstrate to him the actual ritual. They would perform a fake one for him, and then they would repeat, you know, in the inner sanctum, the real one. And no one knows what the real one is. It may be the same thing, who knows? But there are other rules that actually guide that one. It's just the, even if they perform the same one, it's just the idea of separating that from this so-called impure one person and performing it for another audience. That in itself is the difference. And so all of these sort of things become somewhat meaningless in the context of the diaspora Hinduism.
That idea of doing things vicariously, is there in many mothers, for instance, performing fasting rituals for members of the family who are, they know and who are encouraged to, let's say there's the children going to school and eating school dinners, who will be breaking food rules, for example. But there was a very great concern at one time about, for instance, Asian children getting rickets because they weren't eating properly at school because of something they were avoiding. And so in fact they're encouraged by their mothers, by their families, to eat what's there. The mothers perform special fasting rituals in order to. So you know, that's an interesting aspect of the diaspora as well.
Yeah, they made these compromises. For instance, I think even this shift from vegetarianism to non-vegetarianism and the other way around did not seem to happen for religious reasons, though, in the context of Britain. It was either, as you said, you know, concern for health or other variables that come into place rather than ritual reasons or religious reasons. Billy Morier, for instance, suggests that multiculturalism is an important feature of Hindu diaspora in Australia. He argues that the migrants might have come from a variety of backgrounds, from India, Vaishnavites and blah blah blah, but chose to be called Hindus in the context of multiculturalism. So in other words, he was trying to sort of make the point that behind all this homogenization as Hindus and so on, there is this vast amount of diversity, which often is played out in the context of family, in the context of particular organizations, institutions that the caste-based communities built, and so on. From the outside, you know, it simply means, for instance, the Punjabis or Gujaratis. You know, that's what we think of. But once you are in the community, you begin to see the subtle, you know, sort of sub-identities, as social scientists would call it. You know, that's why this whole issue of identity discussions in social sciences is a huge one. Whether globalization is able to really bring about that kind of homogenization among cultural groups and so on, the market-driven economies, are they in the end actually homogenizing our universe, our world, or is it actually driving us apart? You know, so that's the biggest part of the debate. As far as we in the study of religion are concerned, I think what concerns us is this whole debate between essentialist arguments in describing and defining Hinduism or whatever religion it is, or religion in general, and the non-essentialist arguments, sort of arguments mainly drawn from historical, empirical sort of sources, how we actually understand these developments. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you want any political representation, for instance, in South Africa, there is the South African Hindu Mahasabha. In real sense, no one really regards it as the umbrella body. The Ramakrishna Mission, the Hare Krishna, the ISKCON, the Divine Life, all of them don't even think about it. You know, they have their own sort of umbrella bodies, as it were. The ISKCON never mingles with anybody else. The Ramakrishna, the Divine Life, they don't mingle. They have their own kind of sets of ways of doing things, and they have memberships and so on. But then for political reasons, the South African Hindu Mahasabha has managed to become the representative body that informs policy as far as government is concerned. So if there is the decision to implement religious holidays, for instance, naturally the South African Hindu Mahasabha would make representations as to which festivals of Hindus need to be considered, you know, as public holidays or something like that. So somewhere at that level, there is that kind of for political reasons rather than, as you said, for local kind of reasons. When you go to the local groups, they have their own little, you know, subdivisions and so on, and those are the real things in the end that drive their lives and so on.
Very interesting after the Queen of Gorman Jubilee service to see who it was that they lined up outside the centre to shake hands with them, who was seen as a representative of each of the religious communities, other than the Christian ones.
I mean, it's interesting that, you know, the kind of things that you're referring to, the the situation of Indian Christians, for instance, you know, overseas, when representations are made as Indian, there seems to be predominantly the Hindu sort of Indians, and Indian Christians are somehow left out in the game. And in fact, in recent times, actually, they are now organizing their own international Indian Christian organizations. I mean, the so-called, say for instance, the GOPO, the Global Organization of People of Global Organization for People of Indian Origin. Now, if you look at their management, you know, bodies and all of that, it's Hindu-driven. And oftentimes, it also has very deep agendas of RSS, the BHP, you know, the BJP, and all of these affiliations. So, where do Indian Christians actually fit in with that kind of association? If that's a global Indian association, it should be non-religious. But somehow they tend to be religious. I mean, we have in South Africa Andhra Mahasabha. Now, from the name of it, it's supposed to be all Telugus, all people of Andhra, you know, should be part of it. But it is implicitly considered a Hindu organization. So the Telugus, who are not Hindu, don't come there. Because it's, you know, everything begins with a puja, everything happens, they just perform rituals, they perform festivals of Hindus and so on. So in the end, it's a religious organization. So the name as Andhra Mahasabha has no meaning really, you know, and the religion is kind of hidden. You know, if you from the outside look at it, you think, you know, if you saw that name in a book, oh, that's a Telugu association. But then when you actually attend any of those meetings, you know it's a Hindu association. So the Hindu is kind of couched inside the folders, really. So as a result, I believe now the Indian Christians are beginning to form their own international bodies, you know, that they could actually... So at the end of the day, it becomes political, really. These formations, the homogenizations and all of these things are politically driven. So whether religion actually forms the basis for this unity is another question, moot question.
Isn't that more, you know, what is stronger? How do they see themselves? Is it by being, as you say, if it's not by being Telugu, but by being Hindu as well?
Mm.
You know, is there any association that you can make which you could realistically call Telugu, where you could get people in, say, a social organisation, a sports organisation?
Mm.
You know, whereas if, you know, my understanding is, even if you form a sports club,
it will still
it would be,
yeah,
it would be religious denomination, in fact, not.
Yeah. You still cannot escape,
no,
from, because I think maybe by default, because many of them happen to be Hindu, they suddenly change the character of it. By being the majority leaders,
yeah,
they change the character of it. And so the association gets its kind of influence from,
yeah,
you know, that kind of thing. So, and my final comment... Yeah, I think we talked about this Eleanor Nesbitt's comment about vegetarianism and non-vegetarianism and the movement back and forth. So all of these things, actually, when you look at these inventions in their practices and rituals and so on, is it... somehow driven by other considerations than religious, or are they actually religiously kind of driven? And if so, is there any sort of substantial continuity between their orthodox religiosity and modern sort of developments? So I think that's the kind of question that one would have to unpack and theorize as to what it means. You know, how we then talk about Hinduism, how we then talk about all of these developments as diaspora, and so on. Thanks for being patient with me.
One thing you didn't, yeah. I mean, you mentioned but didn't comment on was this sort of gender,
yeah.
Which I didn't. I mean, all traditions are carried on by women, aren't they?
Yeah.
In whatever traditional society. I mean, if you ask in a family who are the guardians of the religious side of life, it's usually the women of the family, the mother.
I think the biggest difference here between Indian practice and here is mothers and daughters seem to be, even in public sphere, seem to be transmitting these things, whereas in the context of India it wouldn't happen that way. It's patriarchal. So if you
even
went
the public
to
public sphere,
yeah, yes,
rather than just in the home.
No, it's in like in public temples and so on. They would take on these responsibilities and perform these chores and so on. So in a way, they become, even in public, respected as the transmitters of tradition, custom, and so on, rather than simply... I think in the early days, one thing that probably created that situation was men were busy, you know, in the jobs, you know, earning money and so on. So they had to make a living, and women were free because they were not employed until the second generation. So the first generation women focused on these cultural, especially in the US, this is what happens. So the first generation women mainly focused on cultural and religious activities. So they go to temples and they organize groups, they call around people and say, you know, this festival is coming, let's do this and so on. So men simply stand and watch. They participate and they kind of become the, you know, willing sheep and goats, you know, so kind of follow.
More passive.
Passive,
role.
Yeah.
Once the whole differentiation breaks down and the women start to have the same workforce as men, that will stop, but the indication seems to be that that's gaining momentum, not losing momentum.
Right. Yeah. So
that way women are more empowered in the public sphere. On the other hand,
yes. Exactly. So how that will pan out eventually, when those women also become equally sort of busy with their lives and so on, professional women and so on, whether that would really continue, you know, the story will have to unfold.
You're talking about the sort of virtual rituals carried out.
Yeah. Thanks, baby.
Which was the making sacred English rivers, and if you really had to, if you were putting ashes in the river, you couldn't get back to the Ganges.
Yeah.
Would that be an alternative way?
Yes.
Of bringing this?
I think that you. I mean, I'm glad you raised it because I kind of almost forgotten about that aspect. Because there is also simultaneously, while these Federal Express rituals are taking place, there is also the other side happening, that is sacralizing the local space. For instance, my colleague in Norway, Knut Jakobsen, he wrote an article talking about how some of these local rivers in Norway, in Oslo and Bergen, etc., the Sri Lankan Hindus have actually made those rivers sacred, and pilgrimages, you know, pilgrimage meaning now going to those rivers, not necessarily going to the Ganges and so on. So there is another kind of innovative way in which sacralizing the local space, you know, those rivers, those mountains, you know, all of those things suddenly becoming sacred. So the idea of sacred space from this classical notion of, you know, the Ganges, the Benares city and all of these as this, you know, ancient sacred cities are no longer the only sacred cities, but there are new sacred cities now. In other words, you can create sacred cities in the diaspora. I think that's an interesting point that you brought out. I kind of almost forgotten about it.
But they're on the Indian model, I think that's the important thing.
Yes, they kind of emulate
India to Norway or Britain or wherever.
Yeah, they would. I think that is true because they somehow emulate some of the features.
Yeah.
Like when the Malibu temple was built in California, they emulated the landscape of Tirupati. Tirupati temple is located in the middle of the seven mountains. The main temple is on that main, you know, seventh mountain. So you have to visualize those seven layers of these mountains. And apparently here they visualize exactly the same thing, except in this case it's in a valley, not on the mountain. So there are seven mountains, and then this valley, this large space, was available to them. So, you know, ideally they probably would have wanted the temple, I mean the mountain top. Again, whether planning policy requirements prevented them from that kind of accessing that space, I don't know. But they eventually built in the valley. You're right, they emulated to the extent that was possible that kind of, you know, sacred geography of India. So this issue of making local spaces, local rivers, mountains, etc., sacred, also becomes an issue with the local councils. Like right now, as we speak, there is a debate in Durban. The Amgeni River, there is a section where historically the Hindu communities living in that area left the ashes of the, you know, the person who is cremated. They throw the ashes into the river. Now, in the past couple of decades, that part of the river has been very seriously polluted by the industrial pollution and so on. So the Hindu societies and so on started making noise, and the council had to intervene and clean up the place and so on. And then in the middle, as this debate developed, the Divine Life Society came up with a brilliant idea that they would actually build in the existing golf course. They wanted the 21st hole as given to them, so that they would build this massive crematorium, and they will build a chute through which they will send the ashes directly to the center of the river, not through bypassing these polluted sections, but it will go right into the middle of the river. And now the debate is, I mean, at the center of this is Amgeni River is now sacred for the Hindus. That's point one. Secondly, now there is no other place that the Hindus could use, so they have to use that. But then there is the issue of golf course, Papua Gulam's golf course that was built there, and non-Hindus and everybody else uses that place. So now the question is, do we deprive the non-Hindus and everybody else and give this place to Hindus for them to be building this particular sacred site, so that, you know, they could use it, or should we keep it as golf course? And the underneath that is another individual issue, that the Divine Life, this is an internal debate now within the Hindus, the Divine Life Society wants to name it and after the name of the founder of Divine Life Society. Now the rest of the Hindus don't want that. They want it to be a neutral Hindu site. So why should? But then the point is, Divine Life is putting up the money. They are investing, you know, those millions of rands to build that site and to create this modern, you know, state of the art kind of shoot that will take the ashes right into the middle of the this thing and then go into the sea. So they will come straight into the river mouth and then go into the sea. So it's you know, sacred space in the construction, in the making.
I understand the Ganges is now in Yorkshire, which is funny because the only place I know in England with seven hills is Sheffield.
Yeah. Soon enough, somebody will come up with this, you know, myth that Rama actually shot the arrow, and that arrow penetrated through the, you know, belly of Sita, the earth, and came up, appeared on this side, and the Ganges is linked, therefore, in the subterranean, through the subterranean, this thing. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.